Hey everyone, you are watching The Jacobin Show. I'm your host, Jen Pan. I am very excited for today's show. Our guest is Vivek Chibber, who has just published a new book called The Class Matrix. I am going to be speaking to him in just a little bit about class formation and other exciting topics that he covers in the book, what we should make of culture and how culture plays into why workers do and don't rise up against capitalism. I'm also going to be making some comments about the Great Resignation in a little bit. But for now, I actually want to just dive straight into talking to our first guest, because you know him very, very well. That's right. It is Paul Prescott, a.k.a. Labor Paul, a.k.a. my former co-host, always the good cop to my bad cop. Paul has not been busy at all and has nothing else going on at the moment. So I thought I would ask him to appear on today's show. So, Paul, how are you?
Good. It's great to be back. I've just been chilling. Wonder why I'm not on the show anymore. Just chilling. Nothing going on at all.
Yeah. So. Well, since you have nothing going on, I thought maybe you could come on the show to talk about some new legislation that some Republicans are trying to push forward. So we've been hitting the Democrats pretty hard on the show for the last couple of episodes, of course, for good reason, but it's finally time to give the Republicans their due. So what I want to talk about is a new bill that is being pushed forward by Marco Rubio and Representative Jim Banks. It is called the Teamwork for Employees and Managers, aka the TEAM Act of 2022. And I want to read a line from their press release that I think summarizes what this bill is trying to do. So in the press release, they write, "If it becomes law, the TEAM Act will allow management and workers to establish non-union employee involvement organizations, also called EIOs, to discuss workplace issues of mutual interest." All right. So, Paul, I know that you really don't like this bill at all. And I want to ask you about that, because this bill isn't really trying to ban unions or outlaw them. The bill is really just saying we want to offer another tool for workers in the workplace to come together with management. So, Paul, why do you hate workplace cooperation so much?
Yeah, well, where to start? When you look at the details of this bill, so basically what this bill sets up, and first of all, let me say, I mean, the title of the bill sounds like something a camp counselor came up with. so that really annoys me. But basically what it sets up is you can have these quote unquote action committees in a workplace, and the workers get to suggest ideas for how to improve things to management. This sounds really great, right? The only thing is none of it is binding. So workers, you can make suggestions all you want. That does not require them to fulfill them. You cannot collectively bargain with these structures. They also make some fanfare about giving workers a voice by giving them a seat on the corporate board. Mm-hmm. But of course, they don't really talk about that seat is a non-voting seat. So essentially, I mean, this is all just BS. And if we really think that a major corporation is going to substantially change their practices to benefit workers just because they're making these suggestions that are not binding and that are not carried out by any sort of action or leverage, I think we're living in a total fantasy world. I mean, but what makes it more insidious is that what companies will do with this and have done, you know, they use that to make the argument that we don't really need a union. And this kind of muddies the waters between what workplace representation actually means and allows them to kind of hold this up instead of a union. And what's kind of interesting about this, too, is that what they're writing in this legislation actually is already allowed to exist. There really is no law preventing companies right now from setting up these kinds of committees, and many of them actually already do. And there was actually a big trend in the 80s and 90s called Team Concept, where basically they got these worker committees together. And really the idea was workers figuring out how they could work faster and with less workers. But there's nothing really preventing companies from doing this already. So this is clearly about a bigger thing of trying to, you know, virtual signal to workers about how pro-worker the Republican Party has come. You know, really hold this up as some sort of victory and showing that they actually care about working people. But it really has no substance once you really scratch the surface.
I want to now bring up a tweet by this guy, Orrin Cass, who is the director of this ostensibly pro-worker conservative think tank called American Compass. They launched in 2020. And actually, you and I have spoken about American Compass a few times on the show before. So he's a big supporter of the bill, obviously. I think he was actually one of the like behind the scenes architects of the bill. And he recently tweeted this in defense of the bill. So he wrote, "Most workers don't want to join a union. Most prefer cooperative works council arrangement. Nothing pro-labor about saying, tough, it's our union or nothing. That's just pro-big labor. Here's an additional option that comes with a board seat. Is it somehow pro-worker to deny them that?" All right, so let's break this down a little bit because he's saying a couple things here. One is this thing that I mentioned before where, you know, the proponents of the bill are saying, well, it's not replacing a union. It's just an alternative. It's just something else that workers can choose to do. But the thing that I'm really interested in this tweet is that he's saying most workers don't want to join a union. You're labor, Paul, so I know you've got some thoughts on that. Do workers want to join unions?
So let me say, Orrin Cass has become my mortal enemy. I know he doesn't know who I am, but if you're watching, you are my mortal enemy. And just so people know his background, he used to work for, you know, that really pro-worker populist Mitt Romney. Orrin Cass used to work on his staff, so you know where he's coming from. But yeah, I mean, this is also what is really insidious about this. So Orrin Cass is using this study American Compass put out about a year ago, maybe called, you know, Not What They Bargained For, where they survey a bunch of American workers. And, you know, overall, you know, they have a good sample size of you know, working class people that they survey. But I mean, and he's using the conclusions from that to justify the idea that American workers actually don't want unions. They want this cooperative model. You know, this is what they want. But if you actually read the study, I mean, it totally contradicts the conclusion they're trying to make. So, I mean, one part, if Caleb, you have the first quote up there where they say blatantly among potential union members, 37% say they would vote to join a union. 29% say they would be opposed and 33% say they are undecided. So I don't know about you, but that tells me that actually most workers that know about unions want to join one. Many workers do not know about them, and it's no surprise why. You know, we know union density is at its lowest since the Great Depression. You know, less and less people have family members or friends that are in a union. So I really am not shocked that a large proportion of workers saying they don't know. They don't know about it. But what happens during an organizing drive? Workers are introduced to the idea of a union and what it can do, but the numbers show clearly what was the smallest number there. The amount of workers who said that they do not want a union.
Right.
And again, he's also saying that the conclusion is workers want this cooperative model. And Kay, I don't know if you have the graphic where it shows, you know, on the question of do they prefer power or management cooperation? 45% saying do not prefer either or don't know. 24% more power, but management opposes. Only, 15% are saying no power, but management cooperates.
I just want to quickly point out also this graph or this question is extremely confusing and even I didn't really understand it. So it's not actually a huge surprise that the vast majority or of a significant plurality of the people who were surveyed were like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Right. I mean, exactly. I mean, and I made a joke to Jen yesterday. I'm just imagining Orrin Cass, this very nerdy guy, sitting down with this tired Walmart warehouse worker after a 12-hour shift, lecturing them about this cooperative model that's supposed to work so well. But again, their own data is showing most workers actually do not want cooperation, or they don't even know what the hell this is. But they're using this very flimsy study to justify these things. And, you know, I want to bring up one more point to show what really the end game is. And I think if Kale, if you have the second quote, they say, you know, this is what the survey presented as the policy reform. Unions would no longer be able to spend money on political campaigns or causes, but they would receive funding from employers and the government to set up training programs and provide health and unemployment insurance benefits to workers. And so my one question to Orrin Cass would be, you know, are health insurance companies not going to be allowed to political spend as well? You know, will the Chamber of Commerce be banned from political spending? So clearly what this is about is gutting the political power of unions. Again, I would love to see if he has a plan for why the Chamber of Commerce should not spend on elections. I doubt he does. But this is another thread you're seeing with this fake pro worker right. And this is something I've heard a lot of them say, including Orrin Cass, which is no problem with unions. I just don't want public sector unions, which, by the way, are the vast majority of unions today. But also they have this mindset that, you know, unions, they're just way too politically active and workers don't want that. But the reality is most unions actually mostly focus on workplace issues. And yes, they spend on elections because elections matter to them as well. But this is kind of shows you what is the end game. They want to gut the political power. And also, I mean, don't unions already provide health insurance, unemployment benefits? These are things that are already done by unions. But, you know, it really shows this kind of insidious trend of this new fake right wing pro-worker populism that they're trying to hold up. But it really has no basis in reality and just is totally fraudulent.
I also want to point out, if it is in fact true that most workers don't want unions or don't really care about unions, why then do employers invest so much time and money into busting unions, into stopping unions from forming in the first place? The Economic Policy Institute, I think, has a statistic that estimates that employers spend something like over $340 million annually on union avoidance techniques and law firms, basically to stop unions from forming. And that's not even counting the money that they throw into politics, as you were alluding to, where they lobby politicians to pass anti-union laws. I mean, if no one wants a union, right, why would they have to go to such lengths?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is another thread he keeps trying to make. He keeps trying to say, actually, the real reason unions aren't growing is not because of intimidation. So there is actually, in that study, is a survey question where he asked the workers, why do you think you don't have a union? Again, the biggest answer is, I don't know. And a very small percentage says worker intimidation. So he uses that to say, you see, that's not a problem. But again, if you are in a workplace where there's never been an attempt to organize a union, of course, you are not seeing the side of that where there is intimidation and repression. You know, that is only going to come once you are trying to do that organizing drive. And again, if you are largely, you know, just unaware about union issues, which most people are because, you know, the state of labor today, you know, you're probably going to say, I don't know why I don't have a union. So it's very disingenuous. But, you know, he's trying to pull on this thread that actually the unions are lying. Intimidation is not a problem. Workers just don't want it. They want this cooperation model. But again, look at their own statistics. It's really not showing that at all.
So I want to just end by asking you this, because we've talked about pro-worker, you know, so-called pro-worker conservatism on the show before, and how it seems to be mostly just bluster. And I actually wrote an article back in 2020 when, you know, American Compass was first launching about this kind of right-wing populism. And my take back then was, this isn't real. Like, this is just like a media spectacle. Like, you know, the Republican Party is just never going to be a home for any kind of serious effort to court labor or start or nurture any kind of labor movement. And back in 2020, that seemed mostly true because American Compass was new. I think on their website at the time, they literally said something like, we don't endorse any specific proposals. So it was like not clear what they were doing yet. But we now do have a proposal in front of us. So the question for you, I guess, is does it seem like this right-wing workerism has sort of found new life? Or maybe like another way of asking the question is, why are they introducing it now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. If it has life, I mean, I think all they need to do really is Their bar, I think, is low because all they really need to do is peel off just enough workers for their strategy to be deemed a success. So, of course, I know they're not actually going to be trying to regenerate the labor movement or do pro-worker things. But I think the problem becomes if they're the only ones talking about worker issues in a real way or trying to make that a priority issue and those on the left or the Democrats or whatever are not, they could succeed, again, in pulling off enough workers to their side. You know, to make a difference in elections and ultimately be able to destroy the labor movement, which is their end game. So I think, you know, it's hard to tell sometimes, you know, what people's intentions are. I mean, part of me thinks people like Orrin Cass truly believe that they can formulate something that is pro-worker from the right wing and actually carry it out in a way. And they actually think they're doing something good for workers. But, you know, I think a lot of this, they're being savvy in trying to think like, you know, we're proposing ideas around the issues that people care about, which is their jobs, you know, and their job security. And again, the danger is if they're the only ones doing it, you know, it might just be enough to get enough people on board. You know, I think similar, go back to that 2016 election. I mean, you have someone talking about trade and jobs and the other person not. So
yeah,
doesn't matter how ridiculous the person who is talking about trade is, you know, that's going to have an effect on people that care about those issues. So I think this is the danger for, you know, I wouldn't even necessarily say the left so much or our candidates, but it's like if the mainstream of the Democratic Party is going to be just ignore worker issues so much, you know, it's going to be a problem because it allows people like Orrin Cass and Marco Rubio to kind of take up that mantle.
Well, as far as the 2022 TEAM Act goes, if we are to believe American Compass's own survey, it's a questionable whether it's going to go very far. So knock on wood. But again, just good to see you, Paul. We yeah. will let you get back to doing nothing at all. Right. And hopefully we'll see you soon.
All right. It was so great to be back. Thanks, Jen.
Bye, Paul. All right, so before we get to the next stuff, we are going to hear a message from our sponsor, Verso Books.
Join the Verso Book Club and get every new ebook that Verso publishes every month, as well as 1 to 3 books in the mail. All Verso Book Club members also get 50% off everything on the website. The Comrade tier is only $20 a month for your first 3 months, and if you join in February, you'll get these books: The Trial of Julian Assange, A Story of Persecution by Nils Melsner, an exploration of the chilling precedent set by the illegal silencing of Julian Assange. How to Be a Revolutionary by South African writer C.A. Davids, an ambitious globe-spanning novel about what we owe our consciences. The South, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives by Adolf Reed Jr., a narrative account of Jim Crow as people experienced it. And Racecraft, The Soul of Inequality in American Life by Karen and Barbara Fields, a new edition of this celebrated contemporary work on race and racism. Become a member today at versobooks.com.
All right. So again, we have an interview with Vivek Chibber coming up shortly. Actually, for those of you who have been watching the show since the beginning, you might remember that he was the very first guest on The Jacobin Show way back in, I guess, 2020. So I'm very excited to be speaking to him in a little bit about his new book. But first, I have just a few comments on The Great Resignation. So, of course, by now, everyone's heard about the so-called Great Resignation. In 2021, a record 47 million Americans quit their jobs. 4.3 million people quit in December alone, and 4.5 million people quit the month before that. Since last year, progressive commentators have cheered this exodus from the workforce as a long simmering worker revolt after decades of overwork, stagnant wages, and worsening income inequality, all topped off, of course, by the pandemic.
This is Anthony Klotz, and he coined a term that you've been hearing everywhere.
The Great Resignation.
The Great Resignation.
The Great Resignation.
The Great Resignation.
Because he saw it coming.
I was talking to a reporter and shared my view that I thought there might be a Great Resignation coming. And since I made that prediction over the past 6 months, we have seen elevated rates of resignations here in the United States more than we've ever seen before.
So why are so many people quitting their jobs right now? Well, for one thing, a lot of people are just burned out. But also, a lot of people have been rethinking the place of work in their lives.
Individuals reflected on work and whether it was really giving them the meaning and the happiness that they wanted.
And for a lot of people, the answer was just no. There's a really popular subreddit that illustrates this.
There's not a lot more at this point that has mass appeal than saying, you know, like, I hate my job, or I hate my boss, or I hate work.
Doreen is one of the moderators of the anti-work subreddit,
which currently stands at 1.1 million idlers or subscribers.
Actually, right now, it's at 1.7 million.
So it's grown since our interview. And that number shot way up during the pandemic.
Just a straight line. Just a straight line up.
And anti-work is now one of the most active communities on Reddit.
It's a heavily anti-capitalist, or at least critical of capitalist philosophy, where people are kind of like calling into question our dedication to work or our over-dedication to work.
Some of them call for a four-day work week and higher wages, just a gentler version of capitalism. But others, like Doreen, are a little more radical and want to abolish work altogether.
So some people have even described the Great Resignation as a kind of de facto general strike. For instance, last year, the Washington Post asked, are we witnessing a general strike in our own time? Likewise, The Guardian wrote, you might say workers have declared a national general strike until they get better pay and improved working conditions. The New York Times wrote, it may be that the Great Resignation is a kind of spontaneous informal labor strike, a collective demand by workers for substantial raises and other gains after decades of wage stagnancy and suppression. If so, history suggests that the Great Resignation could be the beginning of a meaningful transformation of working conditions in this country. And one economist told Mother Jones, workers are creating this sort of collective bargaining situation united by a year of examining our life and whether we think we're being treated fairly and whether we think we're doing what we want to do. So what's going on here? Was the upheaval of the pandemic really the last straw for workers who have suffered low wages and disrespect and who finally feel empowered to say fuck you to their bosses on a mass scale? Is the Great Resignation the spark that's about to ignite the workers' revolution? The story, as usual, is a little more complicated, and I think it's worth looking at exactly what's going on here. So the first thing is this. Although much of the media has been captivated by the stories of white-collar workers who decide to jettison their unsatisfying desk jobs in order to live out their dreams of becoming painters or entrepreneurs or whatever, these professional workers are actually not what's driving the Great Resignation. As it turns out, most of the quitting is happening among frontline workers and in low-wage sectors, and rather than completely dropping out of the labor force, the majority of these workers are simply leaving bad jobs in order to find slightly better jobs.
Okay, we're all calling it the Great Resignation, but you're giving it a new term.
Yeah, I think it's the reshuffling, because it's not as if someone goes in and says, you know, like Costanza, I quit, and they don't have another job. Most of these people are going from one job to another, so they're job changers. And we see this really early in the COVID recession. People said, hey, I'm a frontline worker. I work, let's say, in hospitality. It's kind of scary. Maybe I'll go to a job with better pay, with benefits, and maybe with a regular schedule like warehousing. Right. If you look at, like, right before the COVID recession began in February of 2020, through the end of last year, leisure and hospitality lost 1.2 million jobs. Meanwhile, warehousing up more than 200,000 jobs. So that's a reshuffling more than a flat out, I quit.
How is inflation impacting the reshuffling?
Well, I think that when people are not making enough money to keep up with prices, they're saying, wow, I got to do something. So this is a real big issue. Like, think about this. If you even just go back to that leisure and hospitality, if you're not paying enough to get to 7% better, then you're behind. And in fact, if we look at the Labor Department report from last December, we see, hey, people, after you factor in inflation, guess what? Wages are actually down. Yeah. Meanwhile, leisure and hospitality wants all those people back. Wages up about 16% from a year ago, and warehousing up 8%. So they're keeping track with inflation.
So
this is obviously a good thing because it means the labor market is tight enough that notoriously bad employers in the service sector and elsewhere are being forced to raise their wages and offer better benefits. And even workers in middle and upper tier industries have recently found more room in the labor market to seek out new jobs with higher salaries or negotiate their compensation and work conditions with their current employers. But even given the greater leverage that workers overall seem to enjoy right now, does the Great Resignation actually constitute a collective labor action, let alone a general strike? It's true that the job quitting and the job changing is happening on a pretty widespread level with clear ramifications for employers. And I should just say, as someone who has quit a job or two in the past, I absolutely understand the appeal of walking out of a terrible workplace. But I would also argue that this doesn't necessarily make the Great Resignation a collective action. In fact, in many ways, the Great Resignation demonstrates the absence of collective options for workers, and here's why I think this distinction is important. A collective labor action is when workers deliberately coordinate with each other to build or exert power, usually, of course, against an employer, to win specific demands. The vehicle for expressing this power is most commonly, of course, a union, and union membership in the U.S., unfortunately, is still at the lowest it's been in a century and, in fact, is continuing to decline. If millions of workers are individually fed up with their work situation and decide to quit, that trend may temporarily influence the labor market, but it doesn't necessarily automatically translate to increased worker power. Here's how labor organizer Jane McAlavey put it at the end of last year. She wrote, "If more than 1 million workers, or even fewer in key labor markets, take collective action toward common demands to radically improve their quality of life on and off the job, the results will be far more powerful than those of the Great Resignation. If even a tiny fraction of the number of people who quit in August and September choose to unionize, forcing their employers to improve their working conditions by threatening a collective rather than an individual exit, or by withholding their labor in supermajority strikes, the working class could radically lift the floor on what is considered acceptable corporate and shareholder behavior." In other words, as heartening as it may be to see a wave of people quitting, the Great Resignation cannot fundamentally change the balance of class power over the long term, because the slightly increased leverage that workers have right now is dependent on the labor market, not on institutional power, and could therefore just as easily disappear with the next economic downturn. Now, that said, does this mean that the millions of workers who decided to leave their jobs last year did something wrong by quitting rather than staying in these jobs and organizing their workplaces? No, of course not. In fact, according to Professor Vivek Chibber, who's incidentally, of course, also our guest on the show today, it's actually completely rational behavior under capitalism. So early Marxists often just assumed that workers would just gravitate to collective action based on the shared condition of being exploited by their employer. But Vivek argues that the very structure of capitalism actually inclines workers toward an individual rather than a collective response to exploitation and bad working conditions. The simple reason for this is that under capitalism, employers always have the upper hand. Particularly in the U.S., bosses can fire workers at will, which of course means that they can arbitrarily cut workers off from their income, aka the very thing that people need to survive. If an individual worker walks off the job, that might temporarily inconvenience his or her employer, but it doesn't jeopardize the employer's ability to survive. The thing that actually jeopardizes employers, of course, is when workers collectively walk off the job together, which is why bosses generally will do anything they can to stop their employees from organizing. Collective bargaining represents such a threat to employers that they spend an insane amount of time and money trying to prevent it. According to an estimate from the Economic Policy Institute, American companies spend around $340 million annually on union busting, and that's not even including the millions they spend lobbying politicians to pass anti-union laws. As the labor scholar Ruth Milkman recently put it, employers pull out all the stops to try to do everything they can to undermine unionization efforts, to convince workers not to vote for the union, to intimidate them into being afraid to do so. What this all means is that the stakes for workers trying to organize collectively are always incredibly high. When you're fed up with your job, it's much easier to just try to find a new one than it is to attempt to form a union, especially when lots of businesses are hiring. So it makes perfect sense that right now we're seeing a wave of resignations and job changing. In December, just as 4.3 million people were leaving their jobs, Jane McAlavey came on this show and talked a bit about what we should make of the Great Recession in the broader context of labor militancy and national politics. As usual, it was a great interview, and I think she said it best, so I will let her have the last word.
When I look back at the whole year, I still think the massive challenge for organizers is how to channel this individual, like, I quit. You know, there's even several stories recently highlighting that workers are like going onto Instagram and whatever social media they use before they walk in their boss's office and quit, and like saying it on Instagram and like filming themselves quitting. So there's this like individual militancy and individual anger, but we got to see way more of the kind of collective action that John Deere workers took, or that Kellogg and many other workers have been taking this year, before we're going to get to the place where we're creating a kind of crisis that's going to force the mansions, the cinemas, And frankly, we know there's a bunch of Democrats hiding behind them, frankly, right? But those two are, like, I call them the public face of resistance to all good things. And there are definitely a bunch of moderate Democrats who are like, don't ever back down. You know that crap is happening. That's actually how it works. So we got two of them who have the balls to be the front, you know, of resistance to, like, actual fundamental structural change. And they're not going to change their mind unless and until more workers take the action that the John Deere workers took, unless more workers actually say, yeah, no, we're walking off the job in a supermajority strike and we ain't going back until our demands are met. That magnified many times over is the kind of power that's going to be desperately required in 2022 if we stand any damn chance of not sinking into Trumpism this time next year.
All right. Well, on the subject of labor militancy, I think that is a good cue to introduce my next guest. I'm very excited to have him on again. He is Vivek Chibber, a professor of sociology at New York University. He's the author of the books Postcolonial Theory and the Specter of Capital and Locked in Place. And of course, his most recent book is The Class Matrix, which he is going to be talking to us about today. Vivek, of course, it's good to have you. You have written a new book, which I want to say has a slightly mysterious cover. And just to start, you know, I have to say, I feel like if I describe your book as a, like, defense of materialism or a defense of structuralism, people are just going to, like, immediately close the video. So I want to start by talking about the conflict between capitalists and workers. And specifically what I want to focus on is, or I want to look at the kind of classical Marxist premise, right, that there is an inherent antagonism between the capitalist class and the working class, where, of course, the former exploits the latter. And because of this conflict and because, you know, workers all share the condition of being exploited, the premise is that they'll be driven to collectively fight this exploitation. Now, of course, in the past, we've seen many instances of this happening, and we've seen many instances of this happening successfully. But at the same time, we haven't overthrown capitalism. You know, there's been no workers' revolution, and it actually seems that organizing collectively is the exception rather than the norm for workers these days. So because of this, you know, over the last few decades, there have been a lot of theorists and thinkers who have basically tried to look at this question and tried to figure out why workers aren't rising up against the capitalist class. And I guess I want to start there because, you know, people thinking about this question has led to something that you call the cultural turn. So maybe talk about the cultural turn for a minute and how it kind of came about.
Sure. This is I know it sounds like a very arcane academic question about the place of culture, this, that, and the other, but it's an intrinsically political question. Because essentially what we're asking is, in capitalism, if it is the case that the bosses mistreat or exploit and dominate the workers, then there's a ready option for workers, which is to come together, band together, collectively organize, and do something about it. As you were just saying in the preceding section of this show, Jen. Now, in the first part of the 20th century, that seemed to actually be happening. From 1900 to 1935, 40, Europe and some parts of the global South were rocked by massive social revolutions led by workers and in some cases peasants as well. It seemed to be the case that capitalism was on its last legs. And so out of that, we got not just the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. We also got social democracy out of that same era with massive labor movements and the parties committed to labor pushing for reform or in some cases pushing for revolution. Well, by the 1950s, it was looking like that era was over. Whereas in 1930, many socialists thought that capitalism was on its last legs. By the 50s, they're asking, well, what happened? We mm-hmm. thought we were going to bring in socialism, but instead what we're getting is an incredibly stable and enduring capitalist system. So what gives? Why aren't workers coming together? That's the same question we're asking today. Right mm-hmm. now, there's an enormous groundswell of opposition to neoliberalism. Ideologically, neoliberalism has lost all legitimacy right now. And that's why we're seeing all this churning happening in the political culture. Unfortunately, most of it favoring the far right. But there is this open declaration on the part of the population that they won't take this tyranny of the market anymore. And yet, as you said earlier, and as Jan McAlevey was saying, and as I try to point out in this book, all the opposition is individualized still. Mm-hmm. It's this great resignation kind of thing. So even today, we're asking the question, well, when and where and how will the vast majority of the population come together and act collectively? Okay, so this question has been around now for 70 years, and it's been the question. Whereas in the first part of the 20th century, Marxists would talk about the material conditions of workers and why they militate against collective organization. And by extension, hence, it's kind of reasonable and rational, understandable why workers aren't coming over to unions and to socialists. And that means we have a task ahead of us. By the 1960s, intellectuals are saying something different. It's that the reason they're not coming together is because of the weight of culture, of mm-hmm. ideology, of indoctrination, of socialization, things like that. And very quickly to this view that workers don't understand their own situation. The problem with them is their consciousness is wrong, their ideology is wrong, etc. And this was at the heart of what's called the cultural turn. This entire intellectual trajectory came to the conclusion that the reason Marxists have not been able to understand why workers haven't revolted or come into collective action, etc., is because Marxists never appreciated the importance of culture. Now, that may or may not be true, but it had one very, very important implication, which is that intellectuals quickly came to the view that there's no such thing as objective interests, there's no such thing as structural constraints, there's no such thing as the imposing weight of the class structure, and instead, politics is really all about how you look and understand the situation, how you come to ideologically look at the situation. So politics becomes all about culture now. Changing politics means changing people's culture. And one implication of that was intellectuals understand the situation better than workers do. Mm-hmm. So it fed, and you see it now on the left in this country and elsewhere, there's an enormous condescension towards workers. There's this incredible feeling that they're dupes, they're idiots. What's the matter with Kansas? Why aren't they doing what they're supposed to do? They're mm-hmm. fooled by Trump. They're taken in by this. They're all taken in by various aspects of culture. But we understand. The intellectuals understand. It's exactly the opposite of what socialists in the first part of the 20th century used to think, which is we need to understand their situation. And we need to figure out why it's rational, it's reasonable for them to do what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So this became one of the most important consequences of the left's distancing from the working class. Because as you're no longer involved with the class, it's easy to write the script in which the world is clear to you, but it's obscure to them. You understand what's going on, but they're fooled by it. And that makes it impossible to organize them. It just makes it impossible because you go in there treating them like idiots and they'll dismiss you. And this is the political motivation for writing a book on an apparently arcane topic like culture and the place of culture and things like that.
Well, I want to follow up on that because you're right. I mean, it is very common to hear these days that workers are, acting or voting in ways that are not in their interest, right? Like this is the common narrative that we heard after, I don't know, however many elections that,
Every election.
No, you're right.
I've been in this country since 1980. Every single election, the left says, what a bunch of idiots.
Right. Why do poor and working class people vote for Republicans who are obviously going to pass anti-worker laws, who are going to strip away the social safety net? Clearly, they're voting against their own interests. I think that you could make a sort of similar argument where if there's a union drive at a company and, workers vote no, as in Bessemer, Alabama, these workers, one would say, why did these workers vote against their own interests? So if you reject the idea that these people are dupes or victims of, false consciousness or brainwashing, which clearly you do, how do you explain this phenomena?
It's a very good question. You have to distinguish between two things when it comes to the decisions workers are making. One is their ability to understand their immediate experience of being a worker. They show up at work every day. They're treated like shit by their boss every day. They feel the insecurity of the work. They feel the overwork. They know that their wages are low. No amount of ideology, no amount of socialization, no amount of indoctrination can fool them about that. Mm-hmm. And they're all motivated centrally to do something about this economic foundation of their lives. If you look at polls of American population, there isn't too much disaggregation by income in the polls. But it's remarkable that amongst the general population, year after year, decade after decade, and they're asked, what's the most important issue in your life? It's economics. It's always economics. And if you stratified it by income, you'd find it even more staggering. And true, I guess one has to say this to the American left, even black and brown people care about jobs.
Right.
This is true all the time. They know it. Okay, there's no fooling them about that. So think of that as your interest, your perception of your immediate surroundings and of your immediate circumstances. Now, you want to do something about that. To do something about that now does require going beyond your immediate experience and thinking about strategies, getting the information around what kind of strategy might help you and information around what kind of policies might be policies from the government that help you. Which point you have to rely on others. You have to rely on the media. You have to rely on parties. You have to rely on intellectuals because they come to you and they say, hey, we know you're being screwed. Here's how we can make it better. Now, when they say fight your boss, it'll be better, that they understand. But they also know that there's a wider economy, a wider system, and their individual firm, their individual establishment where they're working is part of that system. And in order to make their factory, their hotel, their restaurant survive and do good enough that they can get higher wages, this thing called the economy has to also do better. This thing called government has to also be friendlier. This thing called trade has to also work towards them. And they don't know anything about that. So now they have to get information from the so-called experts. In the struggle for information, of course, when the media is dominated by capital, when intellectuals are slavish to the parties and to the establishment, when politicians are bought over by the corporate community, what they'll be getting in the way of solutions is propaganda. And of course, they're vulnerable to propaganda at any time. They're especially vulnerable to propaganda when there's no institutions of the working class to give them accurate information, the way unions used to do, the way a socialist party might do. Therefore, they're angry about their situation. You can't fool them about that. But they might go and vote for the Republicans because the Republicans say to them, you know how to make your jobs more secure? Cut taxes. Mm-hmm. You know how to make jobs more secure? Stop immigration. Why wouldn't they be fooled by that? Intellectuals are fooled by it all the time. The people who are most credulous towards nonsensical ideologies are intellectuals. And they actually have the means to sit and read and assess these arguments. For a person who's working 12, 16 hours a day, sit in front of the TV, sees educated people and gets this information from them. Yeah, of course. They're desperate and they'll try any solution. So there's no mystery there. They are not acting against their interests. They are trying to act for their interest to the best of their ability. And that includes the informational resources that are made available to them. And that's why the propaganda was so important.
Yeah, so I want to ask a kind of similar question, which is that in your book, you talk about how a big part of the cultural turn or a big part of the culturalist argument is that workers are sort of actively consenting to their participation in the capitalist system. And what's interesting about your book is you argue that consent does play a role in kind of keeping capitalism like chugging along, so to speak, but that it doesn't function exactly in the way that culturalists claim that it does. So how exactly does this idea of consent work under capitalism?
Well, when what's called the New Left in the 1950s and 60s was struggling to understand how capitalism stabilized after the war, instead of continuing down the road to its implosion, they came to this idea, as I had said earlier, that it was the working class's socialization, culturalization into the system. You see this in what's called the Frankfurt School. You see this in cultural studies. You see with this a very particular understanding of Gramsci that was widely in currency at the time. At the heart of it is the notion that what intellectuals, the media, the church, the state manages to do is to make the system seem legitimate to the workers and therefore elicits their consent to the system. So capitalism is surviving because workers are consenting to their place in the system. Now, what I say in the book is, look, consent can be understood in two ways, active consent, passive consent. Active consent is when I see a particular circumstance or situation as intrinsically desirable. I want it. So if my boss offers me a raise, I consent to it because why the hell wouldn't I? Why I'm in the job. It's only for the money. I consent to it actively. That's seeing it as legitimate, desirable, and therefore actively consenting to it. Then there's something that you might call passive consent, which is the boss comes to me and says, listen, I'm going to actually have to cut your wages. Not only can I not get a raise, things are really bad, and I'm going to have to ask you to hold off on wage increases, and I might even have to take some away. Why do I consent to it? Because even though it's a horrible situation to be in, the option is I leave the job, and if the situation out there is so bad that there's no other jobs, I'll consent to it, yeah. But in the same way as I consent to somebody putting a gun to my head and saying, give me your money, right? This is grudging passive consent. So in my view, what happens in capitalism typically is active consent among the working class is actually quite unusual. Most of them go to their job because they have no other choice. Marx called this the dull compulsion of economic relations. Your economic circumstances compel you to show up to work every day, accept the work every day, and thereby accept your place in the system. Active consent is much more fleeting, much more difficult to acquire, and it's always very partial because even if your wages go up, you're still at the job, you're still being treated like shit, you're still capable of being let go at any time, and quite often the higher wages come at the cost of speed up, working harder, working faster. So what they're taking with one hand, so what they're giving you with one hand, they take away from the other. Consent, mm-hmm. therefore, is always ephemeral. And the left made a big mistake when it thought that the system being stable must be because the workers are consenting. Because then, over the course of the 90s and 2000s, as there wasn't a challenge to neoliberalism, instead of seeing that neoliberalism isn't being challenged, people are ejected, demoralized, beaten into the ground, and don't see an alternative. Instead, there was this view that neoliberal ideology is the shit. It's mm-hmm. so successful. It's so overwhelming that it absorbed the working class into the system. And that was a big mistake. And once again, what it led to was a condescension towards the class rather than an understanding that every single support that it could have had has been taken away from it. And it's accepting the system because there's no alternative. And that's why when the Sanders alternative came around, you saw overnight the political culture change. Overnight.
Yeah.
Why? It's because nobody was happy. They just thought there's no point in participating. They just thought there's no point in objecting to the system because they'll be screaming in the wilderness. This was the neoliberal order couldn't have collapsed ideologically as rapidly as it did if it was based on active consent.
But on the topic of, you know, this widespread unhappiness and also capitalist stability, obviously a key part of your book, which I referenced earlier, is you argue that the class structure itself is able to channel worker dissatisfaction into individual forms of resistance rather than collective. Can you unspool that for us a little bit? Because that's really important.
Yeah. The reason they give grudging consent, I call this resignation. The reason they resign themselves to the system rather than actively consenting to it is not because they think everything is fair and hunky-dory. It's because even though they hate their jobs and they hate their bosses, it's exactly as you said earlier in the show, Jen, the costs, the risks of trying to organize at the workplace are so massive that unless they feel that there's a reasonable chance of success, unless they feel that the risks will be worth it and pay off at the end, they find it much more reasonable to take the easy way out. And the easy way out, there's two ways to do it. Either you quit your job, like we're seeing now, with this thing called the Great Resignation, try to find mm-hmm. a better one. Or what you try to do is resist individually at the job. Historically, the most common form of individual resistance has been absenteeism. You just figure out a way of not showing up. More aggressively, you might sabotage, or you might drag your feet at work, these sorts of things. You try to do what you can without getting caught. You try to do what you can with the fewest risks. This is all an expression of what Marx correctly said was the inevitable tension and clash and antagonism between workers and their bosses. But it's one that does result in collective action, not because they're fooled, but because their very place in the class structure mm-hmm. makes it harder for them and unreasonable for them to organize in most situations. Because it's a consequence of their place in the structure itself, this has a very powerful implication. It means the reason the system is stable isn't because of ideology. is because the structure underwrites its own reproduction. It's because once capitalism makes it so that everybody has to go out and look for a job, the norm is going to be that their main priority is holding on to the job, not challenging the job, not challenging the boss. Their main priority is going to be holding on to the job. Then the challenge of organizing becomes, okay, how do I make collective action attractive to these workers when I know that they know that their backs are up against the wall, and if they lose this job, they'll be worse off than they were even with this unpleasant, shitty job. So their place in the structure makes individualized resistance more reasonable, more likely than collective resistance. If were not the case, the system would have collapsed centuries ago.
I agree that false consciousness is a bad framework, or at least inadequate. That said, I do think it's also too much to say that, like, everybody is secretly just this militant in waiting. And I'm not saying that you're saying that, but I feel like that sentiment kind of crops up from time to time on the left. Yes. And I just want to use, like, a sort of concrete example to try to, like, take this apart. So if I went outside right now and I, like, ask my neighbors or just like random people on the street how they felt about capitalism, like, honestly, it's pretty unlikely that like someone would explicitly say like, well, I hate capitalism a lot, but I can't do anything about it because, you know, the class structure inherently deters collective action. Like, if you ask most people, they would probably say something like, yeah, like capitalism, or it's fine. And, you know, lots of people, as we know, would say, I love capitalism. Like, it you know, helps me make money. It, like, gives me these consumer goods. So, you know, like, I guess the question is, like, how can we respect and understand individuals' stated motivations and actions in the context of these sort of larger systemic patterns that you're talking about?
That's exactly the right question. And the starting point for understanding, respecting, and allotting them the dignity that they deserve is to treat them as thinking, reasoning people who are aware of their situation and not as dupes who might have been fooled into accepting their situation. Now, Ben, of course, if you go out into the street and ask people, what do you think about capitalism? Most of the time, they're going to say, I don't know, or they're going to say, yeah, I think it's fine, because you're at this moment in this country dealing with the most depoliticized population the world has ever seen. And, you know, most people don't think in grand systemic terms. Most people think in terms of their job, their family, their immediate situation, their cousins, things like that. So the first thing in order to get beyond where we are now is you've got to target your audience. And this is important for the left, because the left still now mostly speaks to a generic, typically middle-class audience. That's who they're thinking of when they think of their audience, because they're so isolated from the actual working class. So now, if you say, you take the same question and you go into an Amazon warehouse or a McDonald's or a Walmart, you'll get a slightly different response. But you can't go around talking about capitalism. What you've got to say is, you like your job? Do you like your bosses? You start with people where their consciousness is. You'll get to the discussion of capitalism way down the road when they've had collective action, when they see that there's a consistency in the boss's response to what they're trying to do, when they see that when they organize, the state also comes down, the intellectuals come down, and the media come down on the side of the state, et cetera. They'll see the connections themselves. The way you get there is by first giving them the dignity, the respect of treating them like people who are thinking and reasoning, talking to them as an organizer to figure out where and how you'll find the pressure points in their consciousness, and helping them then see that all is not lost, that it's understandable that they're cynical, dejected, et cetera, et cetera. And through slow, steady progress around concrete issues, struggles around concrete issue, build up their confidence in themselves and in their organization, where they can start thinking in collective terms and somewhere down the road in systemic terms. But the starting point is to treat them as rational, thinking, reasonable people, and to talk to them, not at them.
So on that subject, another part of your book is looking at the process of class formation, right? And something I was thinking of is, you know, sometimes people distinguish between, quote, a class in itself and a class for itself. And I'm wondering if you think that these terms are useful, or if they help us understand this process of class formation.
Yeah, they're essential. One of the unfortunate facts about the last 30 years is the distinction was lost. And intellectuals went to a theory of class, which in which class is all about when people in a particular way. And until then, there's no class, which is, means you don't have a class here, but you have a theory of group formation. Anytime you have like-minded people coming together, now you've got a class. Whereas the distinction between class in itself and for itself basically says this. There's people who have certain jobs, they're in the occupational structure, and that occupational structure can be considered at a certain level of abstraction or a certain level of generality as a class structure. What makes it a class structure is that those people's jobs have certain things in common, regardless of their understanding of those things being in common. What they have in common is not their how they're thinking, not their ideology. What they have in common is what they have to do every day to earn a living. That makes it a structural fact, a fact about their place in the structure. And the truth is, outside of fancy intellectuals, everybody thinks this way. Everybody thinks about, I'm Joe Worker, I'm a blue-collar worker, I'm just an ordinary person, and there's other people like me in the world. That's how they think about it. The challenge becomes how you take these people who are in a common situation, at broadly similar jobs, face the same risks, have to do the same things to make ends meet, and how you bring them together as a collective actor, what we've been talking about so far. Mm-hmm. Now, unless you make the distinction between class in itself, that is the class structure, and class for itself, that is class formation, you can't even pose the question of how to organize people. Because if you don't think there's a class structure and you want to organize, who are you organizing? You're just randomly going to go out into the street and you pick the Wall Street banker, you pick the fashion model, you pick the grad student, and you pick the worker, and you go, hey, let's all make a class.
Yeah.
The reason socialists came to this distinction, as in everything else, was through hard experience.
Mm-hmm.
Hard experience was you cannot look at politics as consciousness raising. You can't look at it as essentially a cultural act in which you bring people together around their values. Because what you see is in the long run, people pursue their interests.
Mm-hmm.
What values they have will be values orbiting around their interests, but they pursue their interests. We found that out through hard experience. It's intellectuals who are confused about it. So if as socialists, you go, we want to organize, you have to know who is your constituency. And your constituency is generated by your analysis of the world out there, not public opinion polls or focus groups or something like that. Your analysis of the world, what its structure is, and that tells you here's priorities. Regardless of what their immediate consciousness happens to be, that's where I organize. And then you build the consciousness.
You know, I have to say, your book is in some ways a bit depressing, or at least sobering, because if the problem is false consciousness, that's actually kind of easy to solve, because the answer is more magazines like Jacobin, or more YouTube videos, or like more philosophy professors, or, you know, more like pro-worker Marvel movies.
Current left, more shaming.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Or more shaming and more hectoring. And yeah, exactly. But that's not, I mean, you obviously argue that's not the case. In fact, the problem lies in the actual structure of capitalism itself. So in many ways, that's like a much bleaker situation, because it's much harder to fight against that. So I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit here, but what I want to ask you is, like, why then, given this, given that the deck is so drastically stacked against working people in this way, why should we still think of the working class as the agent of change? I mean, lots of people have been, you know, challenging that notion, right? I think a really popular one now is to say that the working class can't be an agent of change because white workers are just like too racist to make common cause with, you know, non-white workers. And so we should, you know, put aside the notion of the working class and organize along other lines, like racial or ethnic lines. Or, you know, you could even say, why don't we organize on the idea of like just a more general, like popular front of the people against like the elite? Why do we still care about the working class?
It's a defining element of the current left that it has zero knowledge of history. I mean, absolutely none. It boggles the mind. So the immediate response ought to be, can you just give me some examples?
Right.
Can you just give me some examples? Because exactly as you say, Jen, there is a sober realism that comes with the acknowledgement that capitalism structurally makes organizing hard. And it's very attractive. And I would love to be able to say, hey, man, let's find some other way to change things. Maybe if we put the right guy in power, the great man theory, maybe if we just stick to our ethnicities, maybe racial solidarity is the way to go. Fine. Just find me any instance where that's brought about progressive change. If you can do that, I'm happy to consider it. The reason we stick with the working class is twofold. One, obviously, as the listeners of this show will know, they have a strategic position in the economy that gives them real power against the powers that be. Okay, fine. Perhaps it's just too hard. That might be. Perhaps it's just too hard. And hey, maybe let's settle for second best. As Obama said, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Let's settle for second best and go for, I don't know, some kind of ethnic movement or the enlightened MSNBC watching progressive intellectuals movement. And they can finger wag their way to social justice or, you know, the New York Times and all these people. All right, just find me some instances. You think that maybe, not you, but our imaginary interlocutor, you think ethnic, racial solidarity is fine. Find me where it brought about real change for the vast majority. If you can do that, but here's the thing, you won't, because we have 100 years of nationalist movements. It's like the left does not know that there was an independent struggle in the colonial countries. There were nationalist movements in these countries. And in every single one of them, there was a fight as to what the definition of the nation will be, what the nation of the definition of political community be. Will it be defined by the elites the way in this country today, the anti-racist struggle has been defined completely by Black and brown elites? Sorry, brown elites. I didn't say, I don't know why I said brown. Brown elites. Or will it be, and the way it was in the anti-colonial movements, where in many countries it was the elites who took over and defined the nation, or will it be defined along the needs and the interests of the vast majority, which is working people? You can't sidestep that question. So if you want to go for another, fine. If you want to go for another agent, fine. Just do it with some understanding of where it's led in the past and some. Evidence as to where it's worked in the past. I've put a lot of thought, a lot of energy into this. And the reason I keep coming back to labor is I do not see any other possibility.
You looked at the scorecard.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite amazing to see the left say things like this. And then you say, fine, man, just fine. I mean, you think I'm happy beating my head against the wall, being an academic, trying to convince upwardly mobile grad students that Marxism or socialism is meaning. I'd love to join the party. I would love to join the virtue signaling, race baiting party and play the brown guy all the time. Why do I not? It's because it leads nowhere.
Yeah. All right. Well, Vivek, you've been very generous with your time. So I think I'm going to end with just one last question. And I want to come back to the topic of culture, because I think, you know, obviously what your book does very well is sort of interrogate and expose the shortcomings of the kind of culturalist explanations. But you also make it really clear in your book that you're not completely dismissing culture. You have nothing against culture. And in fact, you find it useful at times. So I guess the last question for you is, For all of us on the left, when is it actually useful for us to think about culture?
It's useful all the time. We can have an analysis of the material and structural obstacles organizing. Understand that when you organize, you've got to show working people that they have a reasonable chance of winning, that what you're asking of them is doable, that there'll be real gains at the end of the day if they join the union or join an organization. These are all material reasons to join, right? But at the end of the day, they still have to take on the boss and they still have to take all these risks and they might have to go out on strike, which means even with a strike fund, there's going to be a big falling off in their standard of living. There's going to be real difficulties, which means that on a pure cost benefit analysis, it never makes sense. In the short run, it just doesn't make sense to take on these risks. The reason workers take on the risks is that they also feel a sense of obligation, a sense of moral commitment to their fellow workers to take the risks with them, to undertake the sacrifices with them. And that sense of mutuality, it requires cultural work. It requires building an identity, building some sort of sense of mutual community, which cannot be done simply through a cost-benefit calculus. Now, that said, it doesn't mean you can just invent militancy overnight. It doesn't mean, because if you take this culture stuff to an extreme, it leads to an ultra-leftism. That if we just exhort the workers enough, they'll do whatever they need to do. That's never the case. You're always disciplined by exhorting them and bringing them together, but around achievable ends, which means you're always constrained what's possible. It's a material reality. So first of all, you cannot organize them without doing this sort of identity formation. But the second point is this. You can't even begin talking to them except through the culture that they already inhabit. Organizing is motivated by concerns for justice. It's the strategic sense comes out of a analysis of the situation that's objective. But the quotidian everyday task of winning people over, talking to them, immersing yourself in their community is a cultural task. If you come and talk to them like some pointy head professor or some policy wonk, but with the culture of our class, they reject you and they will reject you immediately. There is a process of declassing that has to go on amongst middle-class people who are organizing, which is a cultural act. So in order to be able to communicate to working people, you've got to be culturally familiar to them. You can't be patronizing. You can't be paternalistic. You've got to relate to them as an equal. And all of that has cultural markers. All of that does. So unless you understand their culture, unless you respect their culture, you can't even begin this stuff. Therefore, the problem with the cultural turn is not that it takes culture seriously. The left socialists invented cultural analysis. The right didn't. The progressives didn't. It was an invention of the left. If you read Lenin, Trotsky, Luxembourg, so much of their writing is about how to bring workers together, the cultures that they inhabit. That's the language that you use. The problem is it always has to be disciplined by an appreciation of the material constraints that they're facing. And it has to be enlivened with an understanding of the material benefits that they'll get if they undertake those risks, if they undertake the struggle. Without culture, you can't do that. But if you lose yourself in culture, you'll be defeated.
All right. Again, Vivek Chibber's new book is The Class Matrix. It's out now from Harvard University Press. There is the mysterious cover that I was alluding to earlier. Don't let the cover fool you, by the way. It's an extremely readable and like wonderfully clear book. I really loved it, Vivek. So thank you again for coming on the show. And it was really good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Jen. Always a pleasure.
All right. Well, I think on that note, we are going to wrap up, but just want to do one last reminder that, of course, our producer, Young Kale, is going to be doing his members-only Q&A this Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern. So if you're a YouTube member, definitely swing by, ask Kale questions, and come hang out with us. Otherwise, we will see you next week.